Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Julian Schnabel has in common with Dennis Hopper that he's an artist turned filmmaker. I mean, he's sort of made his fame as a painter and is one of our greatest artists, but he, as you know, is an incredible film director, got an Academy Award nomination last year for directing The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. I know he's a friend of Dennis Hopper's, and he's the perfect person to introduce him to you, and we're really thrilled that he's here tonight. I think he just got back from an art show in Florida, so we're glad that he's here with us in New York, where he belongs. So please welcome Julian Schnabel.
Hello. Hi, how are you? It's been a long time. What are you doing? Thank you. Anyway, I'm very happy to be here. I mean, every day above ground is a good one. Anyway, Dennis Hopper is my friend, and I don't know what they're doing with him here, in fact. No. Anyway, Dennis is my friend, and we've been friends for not that long, actually. Probably only, 25 years or something, because it doesn't seem like very much anymore. But I think Dennis is a great artist. He does a lot of things. Now, sometimes that's confusing to people. If people do too many things, I've had my problems with that also. Because I'm not really an artist turned filmmaker. I'm a painter who made a couple of movies. But why would I even feel compelled to address that? Anyway, because I'm thinking about Dennis, who in fact is a great photographer, a great filmmaker, who has also supported so many other artists over the years. We were talking earlier, I mean, he actually was generous enough to actually take pictures of all the other artists that were around him at the time, before many people knew who they were, people like Andy Warhol and Jasper Johns and Bob Rauschenberg and Jim Rosenquist. And then as time went on, whether it was Keith Haring or Jean Michel or me, or he was always extremely supportive of other artists, whether they were filmmakers or whether it was Bruce Conner or George Herms or so many people. He helped so many people. And when I was going to make Basquiat, I think the smallest role that Dennis ever had was Bruno Bischofberger in the film Basquiat. But immediately he said to a first-time director, who was a painter, yeah, sure, just tell me where you want me to be. And Dennis doing that encouraged other people, other actors that were in the movie, to do the same. And really, he not only helped me get the movie made, when I was making the movie, he made me think that I actually knew what I was doing. And later, after the movie was made, when we went to Venice with it, when there were difficult questions to answer that I couldn't answer, he'd answer them too. So, in fact, I didn't even make the movie, he did. But most of all, you know, he's gone mad a few times. He was crazy. And he came back, and if I was going mad, I would definitely want to call him, because I think that he'd be able to bring me back somehow. And when I don't feel good, I call him. And I love Dennis, and he's one of my best friends, and we've worked together on lots of things. And there was a great line in The Prince of the City when Treat Williams says, I may sleep with my wife, but I live with my partner. He's talking about his, he was a policeman in that movie. Anyway, so I may sleep with my wife, but I live with Dennis Hopper. Anyway, without further ado, I could actually talk about him for a long time because I've had the occasion to introduce him a few times. Every time, in fact, I'm the only person that will introduce him. And that's why I'm here. I couldn't find anybody else. Now, anyway, Dennis, I love you very much. I think you'll have a great time hearing him say, just keep your answer short. No. Anyway, thank you very much, Dennis Hopper.
Don't keep your answers short, first of all. You can keep your answers long.
Truly.
I want to thank you for being here. You're so busy this year. You've got about four different movies, including Elegy, which we're going to see a little bit of. You're doing voices for video games. You have a TV show, major exhibition at the Cinematheque Française, so of your artwork and work you've collected. So I don't know how you found the time to be here, even. You seem incredibly busy these days.
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty short.
Well,
that's a short.
Well, you asked. You actually asked me, and somehow I heard that Julian was going to give me this award, so or whatever this is, I'm not sure what this is. Okay. I'm not sure what I'm doing here, really. Except it said Julian was going to be there, okay. So I showed up.
No. We're gonna. Okay, good. Well, here's your award.
No, I'm half teasing.
We're not going to do your entire life story, but I do want to hear a little bit about. I want to hear a little bit about the Kansas day, your sort of beginnings in Dodge City, and I guess you moved to Kansas City. Could you talk a bit about the formative influences in the early days in person, both painting and film? Is it true you studied? You actually took art lessons with Thomas Hart Benton. Is that true?
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
But I could probably get there.
Okay.
He came into a class that I was in at the Nelson Atkins Museum that I took on Saturdays in Kansas City and when I was a kid. I'd studied with this watercolorist, Rocky Mountain watercolorist, when I was 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And my mother put me in this tap dancing class, and I was in with all these girls, and I couldn't hack it, so she thought maybe watercolors would be better for me. So So I was doing this little painting of, I had the rock and the river going by and the mountain and the tree, and you know, so. And I had done this painting quite a few times, and Mr. Benton came in and looked at it and said, kid, you know, you're not going to know what I'm saying right now. I was about, I was probably 12, maybe 11, 12. He said, but someday you're going to have to get loose, get tight and paint loose. So it wasn't exactly studying with him. He just dropped in on, you know. Through the museum.
Okay. And, but that's some pretty good advice.
Yeah. But Kansas, I was born right at the end of the Dust Bowl, 1936. And I still had to probably at least three times a week, wear a gas mask to school. Mm. And my grandmother would open the door and 5 inches of dirt would come in. Wow. The farm. So it was... I used to tell people the first light that I saw was in a movie theater, and I just wanted to know where they were making those movies and how to get out of Dodge. I was in Dodge City, Kansas.
So that was a big part of your childhood, was going to the... Did you have a sort of big, great old movie theater in town?
We had two movie theaters, the Dodge and the Crown. Mm-hmm. And the Dodge was sort of uptown, and the Crown was really ratty. And they played... They played the Singing Cowboys, a lot of Roy Rogers, a lot of Gene Autry. Every once in a while, Wild Bill Elliott. I loved him. I thought he was terrific. He had come along because he was a little more real to me than the others. But but that was, that's what my cultural background.
Mm-hmm. But what was Marlon Brando, I understand, you saw Viva Zapata, was that?
Oh, that was quite a while later. Okay. Yeah. My father came back from the war. We left Kansas. My mother ran a swimming pool there. We went to Kansas City, Missouri, and I lived there till I was 13. Mm-hmm. The time I was about 9 till I was 13. And I started going to Nelson Atkins Museum on Saturdays and taking art classes. But I used to go in and sketch the actors because I really wanted to be an actor. I really wanted to be in movies. I didn't know exactly what that meant, but that was what I wanted to do. So we finally moved to California when I was 13. We moved to San Diego, California. And I started acting at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego when I was 13. And it was a semi-professional theater. And my first part was the urchin in Dickens' Christmas Carol. And then by the time I was like 16, I won a scholarship to the National Shakespearean Festival, which you're really supposed to be in college. And I started acting. They brought the great English Shakespearean directors who'd come to San Diego and work at the Old Globe during the summer, and I would work for them.
And you did Shakespeare productions?
Yeah, I played Lorenzo in The Merchant of Venice, Sebastian in Twelfth Night, Montano in Othello.
And so what got you? What sort of helped you make the move, or how did you get from theater into movies? Wasn't there a detour through television that you did?
Well, I actually started, I was an apprentice at La Jolla Playhouse, which was a professional theater where the movie stars came down and acted. And I was an apprentice there, and I met Dorothy McGuire. Her husband was John Swope, and he was running the theater, which David O. Selznick had started. So I invited Dorothy McGuire. I was just pulling curtain, cleaning toilets, and picking up props. But I invited them to see me in a play. I was playing in Lorenzo in The Merchant of Venice. They came to that, and then I asked for a letter of recommendation. And when I graduated at 18 years old, I went to Los Angeles, and I went under. I had this letter, and I finally got an agent, and I got a small part as a 10-line part in A Cavalcade of America for Hal Roach Studios, which is the one that made the Laurel and Hardy and all those old. And so anyway, that was it. And then I got a part that I read for, I got a lead in a television show called Medic. And Seven Studios called the day after it screened and wanted to put me under contract. So that was January 7th, 1955.
Okay.
And well, I was 18 years old, and I went under contract with Warner Brothers.
Okay. Well, that at 55, of course, was a big year because it was the year of Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah.
So, and
that was my first picture.
Okay. And it must have been a profound experience for your first picture to be working with.
Yeah, well, it was also incredible because I came out, I thought I was the best young actor in the world. I didn't think anybody could even touch me. Suddenly I'm looking at James Dean, and I've never seen anybody improvise before. Everything I was doing was contrary to the method. Everything I did was preconceived. Every gesture, every line reading was all preconceived.
That was the training at the Old Globe. I mean, that was how you were trained.
That's Shakespeare. Which isn't that what, I mean, you know.
You don't improvise with Shakespeare.
I didn't know anything beyond that. Yeah. So, It was strange to see somebody suddenly doing things that weren't on the page.
Yeah.
Blocking themselves in the movies. It was quite an experience, yeah.
Was that something that Nicholas Ray, was that part of his method also?
To he allow encouraged, that? Yes.
He encouraged that.
Yes, absolutely. But, yeah. And it was a great, romp.
And you had a friendship, you had a friendship with him, with Dean? Or?
I had a teacher-student relationship. Mm. You know, Jimmy was really older than I was. I mean, we thought of him as a kid, but he was 24, 25 years old the one year that we worked together the last year of his life. So, and I was 18 and 19, and that's a big age difference. Yeah. I mean, he was in love with Pierre Angeli and Ursula Andres, and he was off, you know, boogieing, you know? But we were together, like, you know, 5-6 days a week. We did Rebel Without a Cause, and then we did Giant. And then he died, unfortunately, 2 weeks before we finished Giant.
Right.
But we were on Giant for 6 months. We were on Rebel for about three. So that was, yeah.
And was it after that that you changed your approach? Didn't you then study with
I threw him into a car one night on Rebel Without a Cause on the Chicky Run, and I told him, you know, I thought I was the best actor in the world, very honestly, and I don't even know what you're doing, you know. So what do I do? Do I go to New York? Do I study with Strasberg? What do I do? You know?
Right.
And so he said, no, Strasberg, you're too sensitive for that. Strasberg will grind you up and throw you out. I said, no, you just got to start doing things and not showing them. You got to stop having preconceived ideas. You've got to live in the moment, in a moment-to-moment reality. You've got to drink the drink and smoke the cigarette. Don't act drinking the drink. Don't act smoking the cigarette. And these will be very difficult when you're on stage or when you're in the movies, but just to do the simplest things because you'll be aware of them. And once you learn how to relax and get through that and live in a moment-to-moment reality and don't have any presupposed ideas about what's going to happen next in the scene, then that's the way you should work because you'll be able to work with your emotions and so on. So anyway, that's so during Rebel, I started to try to work. It was a little easier because everything was improvised, or a lot of it was improvised. When it got to Giant, though, Stevens wasn't into improvisation. So Dean used to, when he got old in the movie, he had me come and watch him because he wanted to know if I thought he was really old, you know, because he was playing a guy 70, in his 70s, whatever. And then he would come and he would watch scenes that I did and he did critique them. Hmm. And that was our relationship. And then he died and then I came and I studied with Strasberg for 5 years here. Thank God. Yeah, really.
And how were you sort of, because you were doing some movies with some real sort of old school directors like Henry Hathaway.
Hathaway. Told this story so many times. Yeah. It's like, you know, you tell a joke, you know, and then pretty soon after you told it, people come up and say, tell it again. About the 20th time you've told it, it's just not funny anymore. It's amazing how that works. Mr. Hathaway.
See, so far so good.
Actually, I loved Mr. Hathaway. I know this is strange, but yeah.
Okay, so I guess we're not going to hear the story.
No.
Just, so,
he was an incredible guy. He was great to have dinner with. Mm-hmm. He was funny. He was charming. On the set, he was a nightmare. What the fuck did I think I was? You know? And if you really wanted to piss him off, all you had to do was put a paper cup down. There are no paper cups in Westerns. Where did I have a paper cup on the center? Okay. I mean, he would have an extra hand the reins to John Wayne 70 times.
Right.
You know, just to make the guy so nervous that it was, you know, because he couldn't tell him, be nervous for me, you know. Interesting man. But I worked for him actually more than I worked for any other director. I worked for him three times after this, after he blackballed me.
So did that, literally, was it then hard for you? You had your entry in sort of the classic Hollywood studio system, but then how did you kind of find your way after that? Because you were sort of drawn towards...
Hathaway had a school mom approach. He gave you every line reading. He gave you every gesture. He gave you everything. And if you didn't do it, you were in another person's movie, very honestly. The films I did with him until the last two, which I did what he said, I wasn't very good in the first one, very honestly, because I wasn't in his movie. I was in somebody else's. I was in my movie, I guess. But anyway, the man never moved his camera, hardly ever laid a dolly track, did any of that. He wanted you to move in front of the camera, but he couldn't tell you that, so he gave you ridiculous kind of motions and stuff because you were now the moving object, yeah. And he would give you line readings, every line reading, when to pick up the glass, when to put down the glass, so on. And now I'm trying to, like, I've just come left James Dean, and now I'm going to, on my own, and now I'm going to, like, not have any preconceived ideas, and I'm not going to, like, you know. So we had a very hard time.
The first clip we have is from a film, an independent film that you did in 1961 in California, director Curtis Harrington, who had really done kind of short avant-garde films. This is an early feature film. Why don't we just see a scene from this, from Night Tide. We'll see a very young, adorable Dennis Hopper.
I told you about myself. What about
see
you?
It right here, too.
Me, I'm a member of the U.S. Navy. You really want to know?
Yes.
Well, my mother, my father left my mother and I when I was very young. So I became very close to my mother. And I've always wanted to see the world, and I never had a chance to. I couldn't. And my mother fell ill and died. So I figured the easiest way to get out of Denver, Colorado was to join the Navy, see the world. But I haven't seen any of it yet.
You will.
I hope so.
Okay.
Yeah, we made that movie for $28,000.
Wow.
Curtis Harrington, myself. And, yeah, Curtis was Jerry Wald. Jerry Wald was a very big producer at 20th Century Fox, and Curtis was his assistant. And Curtis and I have been friends for some time. He did a lot of experimental movies in the early days with Hollywood Babylon.
Kenneth Anger.
Kenneth Anger, and he actually went to high school together.
Hmm.
And they made their first films together. And so I'd known Curtis for quite a while, and he came, and it was the first film that he directed and he'd written.
And tell us a bit about the sort of mix of things you were doing at the time, because we haven't talked about your photography yet, and you were in the sort of art world, and you around this time, Andy Warhol came out to California for one of his first major art shows, and you did a film with him called Tarzan and Jane Regan. Sort of.
I was an abstract expression. Well, first of all, you know, these cross connections of painting, photography,
right.
Blah, blah, blah. I was very fortunate to go under contract to Warner Brothers when I was 18 years old, and I didn't have to bus tables anymore, and I didn't have to work in a construction gang, and I didn't have to do that stuff. And it allowed me the possibility of leading a cultural life. And so I didn't have to stop painting. which I was doing in high school. Right. I didn't have to stop taking photographs. I didn't have to put on a suit and tie and go be something else, you know. I could continue what I was doing. And so I just continued. It wasn't like I thought, and besides I'm a middle-class farm boy from Dodge City, Kansas, I thought that like being an artist was acting and making films and painting and writing poetry and whatever. You know, if I could have played an instrument, I would have done that. I mean, it just seems to be all part of it. And, you know, especially if you're going to direct movies, I think you should certainly know all those things on some level. So anyway, only until, like, you know, the last 30 years have I heard about this cross-disciplines and whatever. Anyway, where were we before I went on that rant?
Well, I was just asking what you were doing around that time. You gave a sense in the early 60s when you were making this film.
Oh, well, okay. Then... So I was an abstract expressionist. Yeah. And I went into the Ferris Gallery, Irving Blum and Walter Hopps had started this gallery some years before. Walter and Keenholz had started it with Wallace Berman. So I came in, it was 1962, and I came into the gallery, and everybody had been talking about the return to reality. What is the return to reality out of abstract expressionism? When is it going to happen? We were all third-generation abstract expressionists. So they had looked at the Bay Area figurative painters in David Parks and Nathan Oliveira and Deben Korn, and they were making some good paintings, but it didn't look like anything new to me. It looked more like they were going back and using abstract expressionist terms, but now they were working with the figure. And I thought, well, Soutine did this before we went totally abstract. It wasn't something that I felt was new. And I walked into Irving, I walked into the gallery, and Irving said, "Dennis, I want to show you something." And he brought two slides, and one was a soup can, and one was a cartoon, and one was Andy, and one was Roy.
Right.
And he said, "What do you think?" And I went crazy. I started jumping up and down. I said, "That's it. That's it. That's the return to reality. That's it." And then he took me out and back, and he showed me a bronze light bulb by Jasper, and he showed me a paint can that Jasper, a bronze paint can that Jasper had painted with the paint brushes in it. I went, "My God." He said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, let's go to New York." So we went to New York, and I was fortunate enough to go in to see all of Andy's masterpieces. And Andy had his first show. The soup can show was at the Ferris Gallery.
You bought Irving one? Blum. Did you buy one?
Well, I didn't buy. I bought one. Actually, Irving likes to tell the story that I bought one out of his thing. But actually, it was Monty Factor and Donald Factor and Betty Asher bought out of the show, and they had to return them because the Museum of Modern Art, I just saw them yesterday, because Irving wanted them all back. I bought mine from John Weber. Irving was selling his for $100, and I went down to the Dwan Gallery, and John Weber was sitting there, and he had a soup can, the same on oil, you know, over his desk, and I said, "How much is that, John? Is that for sale?" He said, $75. I said, "Deal." Yeah, because I thought, well, you know, I got a $25, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. So anyway, I bought The Sinking Sun by Roy Lichtenstein on that trip for $1,100. Mm-hmm. And then I was in Paris, and I saw the International Herald Tribune. I opened it up, and there was the painting. Sold for $17,860,000.
Wow.
I lost it in a divorce. And so, yeah.
Right.
Actually, it's actually rather funny. I bought it for $1,100. My ex-wife sold it to Irving for $3,000. He sold it to his partner, Hellman, for $6,000. Hellman? Wow. So anyway, that was my excursion into, like, you know, sort of pop art. And then, like, you know, the Duchamp opening is first retrospective that Walter Hopps gave in Pasadena in 1963. That was a major moment for all of us. And, like, the New York artists, Jasper and Rauschenberg and, you know, and the L.A. artists and everybody... merged there and got a good look of everybody, yeah. Roche and so on.
And the film that you did with Warhol, Tarzan and Jane Regan, sort of was one of his very first, if not his first movie.
Yeah, what year is that, 64?
No, it's like 63, 62 or 63.
Maybe 63.
Yeah.
63. Yeah, it was his first, I believe. First film. Taylor Mead. And Patty Oldenburg. Klaus Oldenburg. So.
And were you getting a bug to make films? To go into directing might have started to seem like a natural thing for you because you were so involved in photography.
Well, you know, I never thought of directing in the theater because it didn't seem necessary because pretty soon they were going to leave you alone and you were going to be, you know. But the first day I was on a movie set, I realized I wanted to know who that guy was,
right?
Who's telling you everything and telling you where the camera goes and everything seems to be running a big show. So, I started thinking about it. And also, I really wanted to direct a movie before I was 25 because that's when Orson had made Citizen Kane. But I couldn't quite accomplish that. I was here studying. So, I was 31 when I made Easy Rider.
Okay. So, we have a scene from that. And so, anyhow, let's show that and we'll talk a little bit about Easy Rider. Yeah.
We've done it. We're rich, Wyatt. Yeah, man. Yeah. Hey, we did it, man. We did it. We're rich, man. We're retired in Florida now, mister. You know, Billy, we blew it.
What?
What? That's what it's all about, man. I mean, like, you know. I mean, you go for the big money, man, and then you're free. You dig? We blew it. Good night, man.
At the break of noon, shadows even the silver spoon, a handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon. Do you understand? You know too soon, there is no sense in trying. Pointed threats, they bluff with scorn. Suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece, a hollow horn. Plays wasted words, prove to warn that he not busy being born, is busy dying. Temptation page flies out the door. You follow, find yourself at war. Watch waterfalls of pity roar. You feel to moan, but unlike before, you discover that you just be one more person crying. So don't fear when you hear a foreign sound to your ear. It's all right, Ma. I'm only sighing.
Okay. We won't give away the ending.
Yeah, really.
So there's great craft there in the, I mean, I wanted to show a bit of the, what you were doing both with the photography of the landscape and also the editing, the kind of cutting and moving back and forwards at the same time. But you were also inventing. The influence of this film is profound because it showed a new way of making films for Hollywood. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde brought about a lot of changes, but that was really made within the system, and this was made in ways independently.
Yeah, it was. Well, it was the first. I mean, Cassavetes had been working independently, you know, but the problem was you couldn't get your films distributed. Yeah. I mean, we made Night Tide for $28,000, and it was on Time Magazine, 10 movies to see that year, and we couldn't get it in a theater because we didn't have an IA bug. So what happened was that Bert Schneider's father, Bert Schneider gave us the money to make the movie. His father was Abe Schneider, who was chairman of the board of Columbia Pictures. So when we finished the movie, which we made for $340,000, Mr. Schneider paid the unions some money, I think $25,000, and we got an IA bug. We'd made it with the NABIT union, the television union, but it wasn't recognized by the Teamsters. So, and they were the projectionists and control, you know, whatever. So, anyway, that's the way we were distributed. We got distributed. I could have made it independently, and never, no one would really ever seen it, probably. Mm-hmm.
And what was it like directing this? I mean, there are reports that you were kind of wild on the set as a director.
I was wild on the set in New Orleans because there wasn't a set.
Right.
Peter had the wrong month for New Orleans for Mardi Gras.
We're not down there in February.
And I took a bunch of friends with 16-millimeter cameras down, and I went from a Go project to proving myself in New Orleans and Mardi Gras.
And that's amazing material.
And I told nobody to shoot film unless I told them to shoot film, and every time I turned around, somebody was shooting film, and I was freaking out. And yelling about how I was going to win Cannes and, like, you know, where were those lights that I asked for and blah, 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 blah. So my ex-brother-in-law and Peter started recording me. Mm. And so after the 5 days of a nightmare, I finally lost my whole crew. I ended up shooting the cemetery scene just myself, Les Pine, a cinematographer, one sound person, and the actor and actress, and the Tony Basil, Karen Black, and Peter. And it was raining, and it was interesting. So I came back with, I think, 60 hours of film.
Just for that sequence?
In 16-millimeter, yeah. But during that period, then the recordings then went to Bert Schneider and Jack Nicholson, and Peter said, "I'm going to give you back the $25,000 that we spent doing this thing." And Dennis is not, you know, he obviously can't direct this movie, and blah blah blah. So Bert listened to the tapes, and he says he wants to win Cannes. and where were those lights that he asked for? Well, he sounds a little upset, but, you know, I hired him to direct this movie, and I'm going to go with it. So, you know, that was the way we started the film, except the day before we started shooting. Unfortunately, my brother-in-law and Peter stole half my points, and they pulled me into the office and told me that and said, "Now, are you going to quit?" And I said, "No, I'm going to see you on the set in the morning." So we started the movie that way, and I think I made him look really good, and looks like Captain America. And I'm very proud of the movie. And Laszlo Kovacs at the AFI about just before he died, we had showed Easy Rider, the new digital print, and we shot the thing in 5 weeks, by the way. We went all the way across country. There was never any arguments after that. And if there were, I won them. So we went all the way across country in 5 weeks. He said it was the best organized film he'd ever shot. Mm. So, now, then there were problems. Then I come back with, like, 60 hours and probably more like 80 hours of film. And I haven't seen any dailies, so it took me a year to edit it. And there's a lot of music in this movie, and the music is really the story. It's where the lyrics of the music is really a story. But I didn't cut the film to music. I cut the film to visuals. Orson Welles had said that, you know, editing is really easy. Just take your best shots, you know? But, and also, like, I was very into Bruce Conner. And Bruce Conner made these great experimental films. And so I was interested in the idea of the cutting. And also, that dissolve thing that I do back and forth, I was so naive, I thought that you couldn't superimpose one image over lap dissolve one image over right. another, or you'd never win Cannes. You had to direct cut your movie to win Cannes. This so yeah, that was it. And the music I heard on the radio as I was in during that year, all the music that used in the movie, and I wanted to be like a time capsule that reflected the time. I didn't know how. What a profit I would be that that all the money would be put in the gas tank and the beautiful chrome machine was blowing up by the side of the road. I hope this is, we can turn this around.
Yeah.
Weird.
Right. And you came up with also this idea of these flash cuts forward, not just the cutting like we just saw, but having sort of flash forwards throughout the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was so I wouldn't superimpose so I could win Cannes.
And
I've never seen anybody ever use it again.
And how do you look at this period of which has really been kind of romanticized lately and really seen as a golden age for Hollywood, this period that really started with Easy Rider and went through the 70s where there were...
Well, I mean, after Easy Rider, they thought that anybody who rode a bicycle and was delivering a script probably could direct a movie, except for me.
Right. We're going to jump cut forward now to Apocalypse Now, to 1979, the end of the 70s. So let's just run that sequence.
I'm an American!
Yeah! American civilian. Hi, Yanks.
Hi.
American civilian. It's all right. And you got the cigarettes, and that's what I've been dreaming of.
Chef.
Who are you?
Mm.
Who are you?
I'm a photojournalist. I've covered the wars in 64. I've been in Laos, Cambodia, Nam. Baby, I'll tell you one thing. This boat is a mess, man. Woo! Mm-hmm.
Who are all these people?
Yeah, well, they think you've come to take him away, and I hope that isn't true.
Take who away?
Him! Colonel Kurtz. These are all his children, man, as far as you can see. Hell, man, out here, we're all his children.
Could we, talk to Colonel Kurtz?
Hey, man, you don't talk to the Colonel. You listen to him. The man's enlarged my mind. He's a poet, warrior in the classic sense. I mean, sometimes you'll say hello to him, right? And he'll just walk right by you, and he won't even notice you. And then suddenly he'll grab you, and he'll throw you in a corner, and he'll say, "Do you know that if is the middle word in life? If you can keep your head when all about you losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you." I mean, I know, I can't, I'm a little man. He's a great man. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across floors of silent seas. I mean...
Stay with the book.
Hey, don't go without me, okay? I want to get a picture.
There was no ending to the script.
Right.
So we did a lot of improv.
And was it the... You do some scenes. I mean, you have some screen time with Brando. Is that the first time that you...
Well, I didn't have any screen time. I had screen time with him, but we worked separately.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So
you were cut together.
He insisted upon doing his... And then me coming in the next night and doing mine.
Right.
And then him coming back and doing his.
Why was that?
And then I'm coming back, and because we would listen to each other, and that's the way he wanted to do it. Mm. And I was in the outer hall, and he's in the other room. Mm. And so when you see him, and even from my shot, it's a double. And yeah, and at the time, it really pissed me off. And I'm so happy he did it that way, because I would have been intimidated by him. Mm. I wouldn't have been able to go through my dialectic physics and landing on various planets and so on. I don't think he was around. But it was amazing. Francis was amazing. We'd write these things in the morning and then just start improvising off of them.
Like the scene that we just saw, was that sort of...
Was that totally improvised.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can keep your head when all about you. A pair of ragged claws cutting across floors of silent seas. Are you kidding me?
Well, not the...
The middle word in life is if. These are Hopperisms.
Didn't you do poetry reading in a talent contest at a very young age?
Yeah, right, exactly. That's where it's coming from, man. Yeah. And then he starts doing the Hollow Man. I get brand... Oh, it's so funny. It's great.
What did this film mean in terms of your career? Often when your career is talked about, it's in terms of like the series of comebacks that you have. But you've done about 300 movies, so it's not like you've stopped working for a long
That was
periods.
Wonderful. But I went directly from Apocalypse Now to Wim Wenders in Germany, and we made The American Friend, and then we opened the New York Film Festival. That was good writing. I think Francis was still editing Apocalypse.
He must have
because I introduced them to Francis, and they started working together.
They did Hammett together.
Right? Yeah.
And then you did a series of very interesting, important movies and great movies in the 80s, sort of back to back again. We'll see Blue Velvet in a minute, but I wanted to first see something, scene from River's Edge, because you did these two movies that were made in the same year, and really great performances. River's Edge, not as well known. It's directed by Tim Hunter.
But my favorite.
Okay, great. So let's look at that then. Let's look at that first, the scene from River's Edge.
Hey, look. Hey!
Don't do that, man!
What's the matter? Is she allergic to cats?
Cats have claws. Come on, go get that cat and get it out of here, man.
No. Let it explore. You're really attached to this thing, aren't you? I saw you two dancing. Hey, Feck. Are you a psycho or something?
No, I'm normal. She's a doll. I know that. Right, Ellie? But you killed a girl, right? Are you a psycho?
Yeah, probably. What other excuse do I have? You're a biker.
Yeah, years ago. Whew, man. I ain't so much pussy in those days. My beard looked like a glazed donut.
Is that when you lost your leg?
Motorcycle accident. Whole gang ditched me and kept on riding. My leg was right out in the middle of the street. I remember lying in the gutter, all bleeding and shaking, staring at my leg right next to a beer can. And I remember thinking, that's my leg. I wonder if there's any beer in that can. I also remember thinking, maybe they can sew that leg back on, and then there comes the ambulance and runs right over all of it.
Wasted that leg.
What'd I need it for, huh? I got another one, right?
I figure once you start fighting, you're always defending yourself.
Uh,
Yeah, that was a Tim Hunter film.
Yeah.
And I started out the year doing, I'd only been sober 2 months, and I did Blue Velvet. And then I went directly to Indianapolis and did Hoosiers. And then I went from Hoosiers and I did directly and did this.
Wow.
And that was my first three performances sober.
Yeah, all came
sober.
Out thinking, how long were you not sober?
Hmm?
When you say you were sober, how long had you not been sober?
How old was I?
Let's see, 50, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, I remember when I was 18, I had an agent, and he said he drank extra dry martinis with it. Yeah. An olive. I tasted it. I said, God, this is awful. And he said, it's an acquired taste.
Hmm.
I acquired it.
Was it part of, this taste? I'm not going to dwell too much on this, but I wanted to ask if on an artistic level, if you felt you were like sort of trying to have, was it sort of an artistic aesthetic thing? Where you trying to have altered experience, altered states of mind?
Yeah, in the beginning, I thought that was really an interesting concept. unfortunately. Part of me, it allowed me to do it.
Right.
I thought that the people that I really admired were all drug addicts and alcoholics, and from Rambeau to Baudelaire to, Barrymore's to...
Right.
W.C. Fields, going, Errol Flynn, I mean, on and on and on. And I just thought that maybe it was part of the territory. And all the great Shakespearean actors, I should really go back to them, because they were the ones that really got me... Into the idea of drinking, because the stories of them drinking are more famous than their performances.
Right.
Back in the 1800s.
But did you find that there was an element of truth to the idea that you could tap into some kind of creativity in this altered state? Because Stanley Kubrick was asked that when he made 2001, which a lot of people said was sort of a trippy movie, and they asked him if he was... on drugs when he was making the movie, and he said, of course, no, because I couldn't have directed the film then.
Yeah, right. No, I agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Because when I was directing, I didn't do any. That wasn't the truth. It's like doors of perception. I think probably you can open that door once and close it.
Hmm.
You don't have to continue doing it. That's my, I think in the beginning, cocaine seemed to work, In the beginning, alcohol seems to work, especially for people who are shy and who are in the public. But pretty soon that shit starts controlling your life. It's not yours anymore, and it's a destroyer.
Yeah.
And I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I can't have a beer or a glass of wine, I haven't had one in 25 years. I've had no hard narcotics in 25 years.
Hmm.
I do love a smoke every once in a while. I enjoy Cuban. I know they're illegal.
This was... It's an incredible year for you in '86 because River's Edge came out, and then a really definitive performance in David Lynch's film, Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
So let's look at that, Blue Velvet.
Dreams I talk to you. In dreams you're mine.
Let's hit the fucking road. We're giving our neighbor a joyride. Let's get on with it.
Bye, Ben.
Anyone want to go on a joyride with us? How about you? Huh?
Hey. No smile for Frank? No?
Okay, fuck it. Let's go. You want to go with Raymond? Come on.
I'll see you Tuesday, Frank. Right then. Now it's dark.
Let's fuck! I'll fuck anything that moves!
You know, David is another, whatever, this crossover.
Right.
Now, David went to art school in Philadelphia. And I just saw him in Paris, actually. He was doing lithographs in the oldest lithography studio in Paris. It's like 200 years old. It's where Giacometti and where Picasso did their printing. And he was there all alone, you know, blue apron and doing his thing. But he's wonderful, wonderful to work with.
And you got a hold of the script before, and you is it true you told him that you are Frank Booth?
Well, he cast me in the movie never having met me. And so I called him in North Carolina. And I said, and he was having lunch, actually, with Isabella Rossellini and Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern. And I told him that he hadn't made a mistake, that I was Frank Booth. And it was going to be good. So he went back to the table, and he said, I just talked to Dennis Hopper. And he said he was Frank Booth, and I'm sure that's very good for the movie, but I don't know how we'll ever have lunch with him. But very honestly, David doesn't really have lunch. David goes and meditates. He meditates through his lunch. And the first day that we did, I never had met Isabella either. I met them on the set, and we did the scene where I come in and demand my, where you first see me in the picture, where I demand my bourbon, and I proceed to, like, Kyle's in the closet, right, and proceed to have sex or whatever that is I do to her. The scissors,
it's rape-like,
and the blue velvet. Yeah. But that was our first day of work.
Wow, that scene?
Never having met before.
That's an icebreaker.
It was great. It was great.
Wow.
It's really great.
So he had been meditating since, because he just wrote a book about meditation, but he had been doing that.
He was doing it then.
Wow. He
was also like a school mom. I mean, more like a Boy Scout leader.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Because he would say, now, when you say that line.
Right.
And I said, well, that line says, you know, go fuck yourself. And he says, yes, I know. But when you say that line, he wrote the script and he wouldn't say fuck or any of the cuss words. He would go, yeah. So this is a guy who meditates, but
right.
Wow.
Okay. Right.
He's got some strange people out there. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Frank Booth. Wow. Scary.
And so, just to finish the year, we had to have a scene from Hoosiers, which is a very different kind of movie. Wow. It's a movie that you got an Oscar nomination for. And anyhow, let's look at that. So, change of pace from Blue Velvet. But.
Immediately after.
Yeah.
No school this small has ever been in a state championship. I know. I was coach for a while. I won a big game for them. I was coaching the last 2 minutes. I took them right down to the wire. I run the picket fence on them. And we won. And my son, he's on...
How you doing, Dad?
The conquering hero. I heard the game right there on that little Philco. And I heard old Ollie dribble on his foot and then make that charity shot. And I started bawling. And they bring the white coats in here and they put a jacket on me. I was feeling so good, I didn't even mind too much.
You doing good?
Well, I feel real empty inside. And
I have some bad visions. Son, the other night.
No, that don't matter, Dad. You're gonna get better. Couple of months when you get out of here, we're gonna get a house. Both of us. I love you, Dad. I gotta get back.
Son. Oh, I wish I could be there.
I'll be thinking of you.
Son, keep their butt.
Anyway, I'll tell you one thing. No school as small has ever been in the state championship.
Talk a bit about your approach to your craft. We just saw three performances back to back to back that are, that where you just seem to like totally inhabit the character. The acting seems effortless, but it's obviously not.
What do you want to know?
I guess how you do it. If you could
tell. No, I
or you what know, I mean. How?
Well, they're all three different people.
Yeah.
Right. Three different parts. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that you draw, I mean, this sort of idea of drawing on personal experiences?
Well, you know, Strasberg, you know, you work with your senses, your smell, your taste, your hearing, your seeing, and your touch, and you do a lot of sense memories, and you get yourself so jacked up that all your senses are really out of whack, okay? You don't need alcohol or drugs to do it, but you can fall in, unfortunately, to that pattern. But you do that, and then you learn to do emotional memories, but Strasberg said, after 5 years of working, unless you really find yourself having problems, you shouldn't have to go back to doing those things. You should read the script, and your first impression of the script should be the right one. After that, you're only intellectualizing, and. I believe that. Also, I believe that if you're doing a novel, don't read the novel. You're not doing a novel. You're doing a screenplay,
right?
Because you're gonna want to take a lot of stuff, and you know, it's crazy. So stick with that. And you know, every part has different qualities. They're about different things. So that's indefinable. I don't know where to go.
But
from
and
there.
Is it a matter of finding it for yourself? Like, how important is the director actor relationship to somebody who's so experienced?
A director to me is the best directors are the one who set up a very comfortable situation for you and allow you to do your work under their imaginary given circumstances. Mm-hmm. When I did Elegy with Sir Ben Kingsley, we didn't discuss this scene and sit around talking. Our first scene in the movie was actually our first scene that we shot, and we sat down and started doing the lines, and by the third take, we'd already printed that, and we were gone.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like, you know, and it was, we'd never met before, really. We'd met a couple times. I'd shook his hand at a couple of parties, but I'd never even spoken to him. And it was as if we'd known each other for 40 years. And it was immediate. And he lives in the moment. And it's a moment-to-moment reality with him. And he gives and takes, and it's real. And and if you live with that kind of actor, what a wonderful day it is, you know?
So you'll...
So like the character in Elegy, I think probably... I didn't think that I had to do a lot of things. I thought that I really could be a professor in a university, and I really could, you know, be a poet and have won the Nobel surprise. It wasn't a stretch for me. I know that's maybe too much ego, but I didn't think that I had to change too much to play that part.
Yeah.
Whereas Frank Booth is a whole other thing. I mean, I'm walking differently, and also a shooter in Hoosiers. Actually, all three of those characters are physically different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're physically different.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, you know, Dean Stockwell, I was talking to Dean the other day up in Taos, New Mexico. He's been an actor since he was 4 years old. He was in Anchors Away, you know, with sang with Frank Sinatra, Anchors Away, when he was four. So I said something to him about something, and he said, well, I hope so. We're professional actors.
Yeah.
Meaning, by this time, we should really know how to do that.
after 300 films and TV shows. Right. But the physical things that you talk about, like the different walk or the different way you physically behave, does that flow out of? Do you work from the outside in? Some actors like find those physical things first, and then that
I'll
helps
tell you, them. A lot of things have to do with who you're working with
mm-hmm.
as an actor, what the other actor is up to. Because, you know, sometimes you need to, like the scene in Easy Rider. I wanted Peter to say the stuff that I had to say in that scene.
Hmm.
It works out perfectly this way. It's much better. Yeah. But he refused to say it. He didn't want to shoot the scene. So, you know, we blew it, is what he, you know, which is, you know, really good, and it works perfectly. But I wanted him to tell about how we blew it. That being criminals and going against the society and doing things like that, that wasn't being an American, man. And like you either should change the laws or whatever. I wanted to get into more of that kind of thing there, which is a good thing I didn't because it's preachy and so on.
Yeah.
He said, I refuse to do that and so on. This movie's over. I'm the producer. I said, well, just we need this scene, Peter. And anyway, it's in the picture, but...
Yeah.
It has a lot to do with who you're working with as an actor. If you want the scene to be good, then you sometimes have to compromise and do various things to make it work. You know, I don't know where I'm coming from with this,
mm-hmm.
but beyond that, when you're working with somebody like Sir Ben Kingsley or some really some wonderful actors, things become a lot easier.
Yeah, I guess probably one of the best compliments you could get as an actor is something I read in a review of Elegy, which is that, this is probably what he's like in real life. Like the idea that...
That's cool. I read one that said, why would you take an ex-biker and make a poet out of him?
Well, we'll see now why you would do that, because we have a scene from Elegy, which is an adaptation of a novella by Philip Roth, which I guess you didn't read. Did you avoid reading it before then?
The Dying Animal, I didn't read.
Just two, okay.
I hear it's very different, by the way.
Yeah. So let's see this moment from the film with Ben Kingsley.
Why don't you take her to the prom?
No, you don't get it. This girl is... She's a throwback to a completely different time. She has to be wooed.
I thought we were talking about sex.
You know, for a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, sometimes you display a remarkable lack of imagination.
That's why they gave me the prize.
Don't tell me you've never been through the process talking the talk.
That's why I have a family, for Christ's sake. I talk to them. Maybe you should get married again.
George!
Bifurcate your requirements. You know, talk the talk with your wife if you feel like it. Go to the museums, look at all the Goyas that you want. But keep the sex part just for sex. All right.
Do you really still talk to your wife, George?
No. One all.
Oh, 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 oh! I'm not hitting that.
I really like this movie. This movie's Isabella Coixet, young Spanish woman who directed it. She does her own cinematography. She puts a camera on a bungee cord, And she's wonderful. She makes such a comfortable situation. And there isn't one bad performance in this movie, in my opinion. There are only about six or seven of us in the film. And it's just a wonderful Philip Roth, from a Philip Roth novel, The Dying Animal. But it's a beautiful film. It really is.
And it does have that flavor of just being sort of captured, the look of the film and the way it's directed, where it's just like a captured moment.
Yeah. And it's so poignant. I mean, mm-hmm. The male and female relationship is so vulnerable, mm-hmm. and it's comic, and it's tragic, and it's strong. It's beautiful, beautiful film.
Yeah, dude. I wanted to. We mentioned this exhibition that's up at the Cinémathèque Française. It's actually up now. If any of you can go to Paris, I recommend that you go see this. And it's a combination of a big retrospective of your work, your films, television work, but it's also your artwork and work you've collected and your photographs and artifacts. So I thought we could just we have a little slideshow with some images from the exhibition, and if you could maybe talk us through it a bit. So I don't know if we're ready with the PowerPoint. We have here we go. So this is
a poster.
The poster for the show, and you have the motorcycle.
New Hollywood, I think that's what it says.
Yes. And you have the motorcycle on display, the Captain America motorcycle.
There's an Italian, the very good copy. The originals were destroyed.
Right. Okay, so let's
there's go to a the, lot around that say they are.
Okay, so this is actually a...
Within a man of light, there's only light. Within a man of darkness, there's only darkness. It's a self-portrait.
Right.
Light box.
Photograph, not paint.
That I made, sometime digital, that I made quite a while ago, about 10 years ago, maybe longer.
Okay. Well, and the next one is a collage.
That's a photograph, which I actually did here in New York, and it's 6 foot by 4 foot.
I think it's called.
UFOs. And
New York UFO, I think it's called.
Religion.
This is just a photograph. You've done collage work as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So these first slides are all your artwork. So I think we have a paint. Let's go to the next one.
That's a big billboard. That's 22 feet by, 16 feet by 22 feet. It's from a photograph that I took, a black and white photograph that I took in the 60s in a billboard. It was one of those turning billboards. And so I decided I wanted to make it into color and make it into a billboard. So, it was for Clairol, different color hair, so I made the lips different colors. Maybe it was for lipstick.
Okay, and then I think we have a painting next. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, that's an early painting that I've never shown anybody. I mean, I let the French go into my house, and they did 3.5 years of research. They pulled out things that. Well, I've never shown this. It's a painting of mine from. About 20 years ago, something like that.
Okay, next one. Okay, this is...
That's me directing Easy Rider.
Right.
Okay. I think that's... that's Robert Walker.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and go ahead. And this is Warhol.
That's Andy's portrait that he did. I was... this is from the last movie, actually, a film that I directed and made in Peru. And Jim Meeker, a friend of mine from Texas, had me send him this, and he gave it to Andy to have it made for the Bass family. The Bass family bought 5 of these in Texas.
The last movie is a great film that was made. It was made after Easy Rider, I think, made in 71. Yep. But it was you had worked, prepared it, or had it... in mind to make for a long time?
Well, Stuart Stern wrote the screenplay, and I wrote the story with him. I'd wanted to make it as my first film, and I couldn't get financing. So as soon as I made Easy Rider, I went and made this immediately.
Right.
And I ended up in Peru doing it in Peru because they wouldn't let me shoot. I'd written it about Mexico, but they wanted to give me a censor on the set. And I couldn't deal with that. So I went to Peru.
Okay, next one.
That's Apocalypse Now.
I think this is just a still from the actual film, from Apocalypse Now. Yeah. And I think there's one more.
That's Bob Dylan and I. Yeah. That's a movie I directed called Backtrack with Jodie Foster.
Right. Yeah. And Dylan did actually write a song for you for Easy Rider, right? I mean, you.
Well, he wrote, at the end, the river flows, it flows to the sea. Wherever that river goes, that's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to use It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding, it, and continue it on. And he said, no, here, give this to McGuinn and have him put some music to it. He'll know what to do. And he wrote the lyrics and gave it to me.
Okay. Is that it? I think, is there one more, or is that the last? Okay, there we go. Thank you. So,
And McGuinn made a lot of money, actually, of the Ballad of Easy Rider.
One of the things you did this year, you kind of got in the news, I guess, during the campaign, during the election, as a sort of, I guess, a large group of registered Republicans who voted for Obama. Could you talk about that?
Were there a large group?
I think there were. Apparently there were, but could you talk about that?
During the Reagan period, I wasn't a great fan of Reagan's. I didn't think he was that great an actor, but I read Thomas Jefferson during that period, and Jefferson said, if one party's in power more than 20 years, it's a citizen's responsibility to make sure the other party gets in if you're going to have a democracy or a republic. So that was gnawing on my mind. So anyway, I voted at that time republic, and I was the first time in my family that anybody had ever done that. And I stayed with them till now. I couldn't really do that anymore, and I felt it was my responsibility. And I think Obama's incredible. I like him as a person. I had the privilege of meeting him. I had a great meeting with him, actually. Uh-huh. My wife is a big supporter. Mm-hmm. And so I met him when he just became senator in Washington, and then we went to the inauguration when he announced that he was going to run for president. And that morning, he had announced that he was going to be run for president at Independence, where Lincoln had announced.
Springfield,
where Lincoln had announced he was going to run for president. And then he went to, and that was about 5,000 people. Then he spoke in front of about 8,000 in Chicago, and I saw that. And then we went to another place where he spoke in front of about 300 people, and I saw that. And then suddenly I was on an elevator with him, and I was standing, right next to him, and it was very crowded. We were all pushed in together. And he turned to me and he said, you know, Dennis, I've been really remiss. I know you lost your mother a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. I also know that your mother was from Kansas and my mother's from Kansas, and I know what it's like to lose a mother. And I should have really gotten in touch with you before this. Mm. But I thought that the man had the presence of mind and all this to like have some sort of human connection with the person standing next to him was really very clear, amazing, amazing man. And obviously got to me.
Yeah, got your vote.
So, and I just hope, we're in a really hard time right now. So I just hope everything goes well, and I'm sure it will.
Okay, on that tenuous optimistic note, I guess we'll end. But thanks so much for being here, and congratulations on Elegy and on all of your great work.
Well, thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.